CA.
Tune in Sundays at 11 p.m. for Orchestral Maneuvers After Dark with me, DJ Squared. Each episode features a great mix of new and vintage, Canadian and international, new wave, punk, post-punk, garage rock, pop, electronica, ambient, and even the occasional remix. Sweet beats are in store for all to enjoy. Join in the fun, OMD, every Sunday at 11 right here on CFRC 101.9 FM.
CFRC 101.9 FM has new social media. Find us on Instagram and Facebook at CFRC Music and keep up with the latest announcements about our programming and projects. Follow us today at CFRC Music.
From Turtle Island to Palestine, occupation is a crime. Free, free Palestine! You're listening to Radio Free Palestine.
Welcome, everyone. You are listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario.
News out of the Middle East. Hezbollah has confirmed its leader, Hassan Nasrallah, was killed in a massive Israeli strike in Beirut on Friday. Israel says the strike targeted the Hezbollah leadership meeting at their headquarters in an underground bunker. Jeff Semple joins us now with more from Tel Aviv. Jeff, what's the reaction been there to the news of the Hezbollah leader's death?
Yeah, we are seeing a real wave of reaction washing right across the Middle East. And perhaps no surprise, it is hard to overstate what a huge blow Nasrallah's death is to the Lebanese militant group Hezbollah, which he has led since 1992, after his predecessor was also killed by an Israeli strike. The 64-year-old Nasrallah was seen by his supporters in Hezbollah as a kind of father figure. He was revered, one of the best-known, most influential figures in all of the Middle East, who played a key role in transforming Hezbollah from a militia into an absolute power player in this region, both politically and militarily, a stronger military than Lebanon's own army. And Hezbollah and Nasrallah were also a key part of Iran's influence right across this region. Under Nasrallah's leadership, Hezbollah also trained fighters for Hamas, as well as militias in Iraq and Yemen, to launch attacks on Israel. So it's perhaps no surprise then, of course, that many Israelis appear to be in an almost celebratory mood in response to the news of his death, notwithstanding the fact, of course, that this country is still under attack and is still trying to rescue more than 100 Israeli hostages being held in Gaza. We are seeing celebrations on the streets in Syria, in rebel-held areas like Idlib. Of course, Nasrallah, Hezbollah were a key ally of Syrian dictator Bashar al-Assad. Elsewhere in Lebanon and parts of Lebanon, as well as Iran, we are seeing mourning, people taking to the streets, firing guns in the air. And in Lebanon, from what we're hearing and seeing, there is a real sense of panic. We are seeing long lineups at grocery stores, people buying water at ATMs, getting cash out. The Lebanese government has called an emergency meeting for this evening to discuss the situation, reflecting the fact that there are real concerns about what could come next.
Hassan Nasrallah for decades led Hezbollah and oversaw significant developments within the militant group, oversaw, ending Israel's occupation of southern Lebanon, Hezbollah's sort of transformation into having a more heavy involvement in Lebanese politics with MPs, parliamentarians, ministers, and so on, and also led Hezbollah when it began to expand more regionally, notably in Syria, where they played a pivotal role in keeping Syrian President Bashar al-Assad in power. The news really shocked all of Lebanon, both supporters and people who oppose him. I recall I was on the streets here in Beirut when the news happened, and some of his supporters were screaming. They were way shocked by the news, and they thought that this was a leader. Some told me that they felt like he was immortal, almost. And of course, his assassination, on top of a handful of Hezbollah leaders, seven senior leaders over the past 8 days, really rattled the organization. Even the deputy leader, Naim Qassem, said so today.
Let's look at this intelligence failure for Hezbollah, because it is astounding, really. This is a man who didn't make public appearances, didn't use the telephone. Security around him was so tight. I remember a few years ago going to one of his press conferences in the southern suburbs of Beirut. Terribly tight security. And then when you got in there, he wasn't even there. He was on a screen answering the questions from us reporters because he didn't want to be in any room where he could be at risk. Tell us what you think about the intelligence failure and the sort of capabilities that Israel clearly built up here. Were they technological or were they actually intelligence assets? Were they spies in Hezbollah's camp, in your view?
Well, I think if you look at what happened here, this is a case of Hezbollah underestimating Israel in the way that Israel underestimated Hamas, and that led to the October the 7th attacks. And indeed, I think that probably influenced Hezbollah's thinking here vis-a-vis Israel. They saw that Israel didn't see October the 7th coming. They saw the massive intelligence failure. It probably made Israel look quite a lot like a paper tiger. You know, Israel is famed for its intelligence agencies, and they either didn't see it coming or let those warnings, basically ignored the warnings that there was a Hamas attack coming. So Hezbollah probably saw that and thought, hey, you know what? We're not as scared as the Mossad as we might be because of what happened there. But actually, that was a mistake, because it was the fact that Israel had poured all of its resources into monitoring Hezbollah, to penetrating Hezbollah, to compromising Hezbollah, that meant they ignored Hamas, and Hamas were able to commit those attacks on October the 7th, which led us to the current escalation, the war we see us in today. Any intelligence operative will tell you that, you know, this myth of an all-seeing intelligence agency is wrong. Intelligence agencies, like any other agency, have limited resources. They choose where to put them at direction from political leaders and from military leaders. And since 2006, all of those Israeli eyes, if you like, have been on Hezbollah and not on Hamas. And that is how Israel managed to carry out some of the recent attacks that we've seen. And Hezbollah, every single opportunity, underestimated Israel. There was the attacks on the pagers, and then the next day, the attacks on the walkie-talkies. Hezbollah didn't throw out those walkie-talkies. You had incidents like the commander of the Radwan unit being hurt in a pager explosion, coming out of hospital, and the next day calling a meeting of senior Radwan commanders who were all then killed by Israel. So it seems that at each turn, Hezbollah seemed to think, you know what, okay, Israel has used all of its secret weapons. We can now carry on with business as normal. And that is a mistake that Nasrallah paid for with his life.
President Biden and Vice President Kamala Harris both called the killing of Nasrallah a, quote, measure of justice. Israel likely used U.S.-made bombs in Friday's attack that leveled several high-rise apartment buildings. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu gave the order to kill Nasrallah shortly after giving a speech before the U.N. General Assembly. Before his remarks, dozens of diplomats walked out of the U.N. General Assembly hall in protest. Meanwhile, Monday's attack targeted senior figures in the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, a Palestinian militant group. The strike leveled another apartment building.
There are still people under the rubble, people we have not been able to rescue yet. We are doing everything we can to save them as quickly as possible.
Today, Israel killed the head of Hamas in Lebanon, along with his wife, son, and daughter, in a strike on their home in a Palestinian refugee camp. Meanwhile, Israel forces launched a wave of airstrikes on Yemen Sunday, targeting the city of Hodeidah for the second time in recent months in response to missile fires by Houthi militants.
Israel is shooting here, and Israel is assassinating there, and Israel is bombing here, and Israel is bombing there. Where are we aiming to? What comes next? This thought that Israel can solve everything by force, and the war is always the first answer for everything, must change, because otherwise we will really find ourselves one day totally lonely in the world.
You know, as a security studies scholar, if I was an advisor to the Israeli government, which isn't likely to happen anytime soon, I would suggest that, yeah, exactly. You know, you've had these successes. you're on a high, basically take the off-ramp, agree to a ceasefire, and end things there. But I just don't think that's how Netanyahu is thinking at the moment. And I think that's why Nasrallah is now a dead man, because he underestimated Netanyahu. He miscalculated here. He thought that Netanyahu would agree to a ceasefire, that he could sort of do this low-level attritional warfare on the northern border to basically put more pressure on Netanyahu by making, you know, all those mass displacement, causing that mass displacement of 60,000 Israelis, put more pressure on Netanyahu to agree to a ceasefire in Gaza. And he just failed to understand Netanyahu, and he failed to understand Israeli politics. First of all, Netanyahu is beholden to a far-right coalition. These are not people who want the war to end anytime soon. In fact, we know that some of the opposition to the strike on Nasrallah came from far-right members of Israel's cabinet, because they were worried this would disrupt their operations in Gaza. You know, they want to keep quietly carrying out Israel's entrenchment in Gaza so they can resettle that territory. They were even, that's actually something that makes them a little bit more scared of a regional war and major escalation. And also, Nasrallah underestimated the effect of October the 7th on Israel's society. You know, there were so many observers of Israeli politics on October the 8th who said, right, Netanyahu is finished. There is no way back from this massive psychological wound and physical and economic cost on Israel's society. Netanyahu is called the magician for a reason, okay? He just keeps on going forever.
The problem is, for a year or two, they talked about the unified arena, meaning that the Yemenis, Iraqis, and Syrians were all supposed to interfere, but at the end only Hezbollah acted on October 8th. I think it was an ethical stance more than a political or military decision taken by the Secretary General of Hezbollah based on their religious doctrine. Now, did he know that this would last this long and he would find himself alone in the confrontation?
So did we go today from a unified arena to Hezbollah alone in the Lebanese arena?
Today there are many questions, but for the negotiations, the goal was to separate Gaza from South Lebanon to avoid an all-out war. But what is an all-out war? That Iran will enter the war? Not going to happen. Or that Iraq will interfere? But the Iraqis backed away. And the Yemenis? They just fire a missile, and then Israel pretends that the Yemenis will destroy Tel Aviv, and they respond with a massacre. They responded to a first missile by bombing the port of Hodeidah. In my opinion, Iran was the smartest and didn't respond to
the killing of Ismail Haniyeh.
Since the assassination of Hassan Nasrallah, other senior officials have been assassinated as well, and the airstrikes aren't stopping, they're continuing. Of course, experts say that Iran is sort of in a policy dilemma. You know, Iran has dealt with several attacks that are widely blamed on Israel, including a strike on a consulate building in Syria and the killing of Hamas leader Ismail Haniyeh in Tehran in late July. Iran hasn't necessarily responded in such a decisive way. And the question is, you know, what are Tehran's red lines? We don't know how they're going to respond to that and what this means for the region. What we do know is that, you know, they've sort of maintained that they're going to keep piling diplomatic pressure. This is according to statements from different Iranian government officials. But the big question is, given the, the severity of this attack, you know, will this eventually not just widen the war in Lebanon, but also have a regional component? Iran has, proxies in Yemen and Iraq, and there's a lot of speculation as to whether they will be involved or not.
We're trying to make sense of what's going to happen next in the region. The problem, I think, is there are so many things we don't know. We know that Nasrallah is dead. We know that other key leaders are dead. We don't, though, know about Hezbollah's command and control. We don't know how much of its vast arsenal of missiles and drones and the rest has survived intact. That's the problem with this discussion, isn't it?
Absolutely. In fact, as you mentioned, there are more unknowns than there are facts that we're aware of. Importantly, we don't really know how Hezbollah is going to react. Will it exercise what the Iranians call strategic patience, or will it try and seek revenge for the death of its longtime and very influential leader?
We just don't know how Hezbollah will respond. But at the same time, it's hard to see Hezbollah actually launching a sustained, strategically calculated campaign now. They've lost so much of their senior leadership. They've lost also thousands of fighters from these pager and walkie-talkie explosions. And as the previous guest mentioned, Hezbollah is very much constrained at the moment. It's constrained by Lebanese public opinion and a feeling that, you know, it feels like it's kind of on the ropes here. It doesn't want to invite Israel to basically launch an all-out war in Lebanon. There's a consistent and rightful fear that what happened in the Gaza Strip could happen in Lebanon. And also, I think there's probably voices in Iran, in Tehran. There's this debate between radicals and more moderates, with the moderates saying, for example, look, don't let Israel goad us into a regional war. That's what Netanyahu is pushing for, because Netanyahu wants to come out triumphant and say, yes, October the 7th happened on my watch, but I've managed to create such a new regional reality that Israel is more secure and more of a hegemon than ever before. So I think there's probably this feeling of caution in Iran and indeed in Hezbollah, and rightfully so. If you'd have said to me that a few months ago that Israel might strike Iran and might target senior Iranian leaders, I'd say there's absolutely no chance of that happening. Today, I'm not so sure. There really is no telling how far Israel is willing to escalate the current situation. They feel like the momentum is on their side. They feel like time is on their side. And I think the next potential step would be a grand invasion of Lebanon. I think that would be a disaster for Lebanon. And I think it could go very, very wrong for the IDF and allow Hezbollah to recuperate and recover their image. But I think, unfortunately, an escalation is on the cards.
In your opinion, what did Hezbollah and Hamas achieve by entering this war with Israel and with Netanyahu in particular?
I said it before that militarizing revolutions, when dealing with a country like Israel, I don't think it will lead to victory. At the end, all of them will declare their victory tomorrow. If the Hamas leader Yahya Sinwar stayed alive, he will declare his victory. And Hezbollah, whatever the results, I mean, yesterday they were declaring victory in the protests in Beirut. And the battle is not over yet. We are focusing on Israel's aims and say that Israel failed in bringing back the hostages. But it is very important to understand we shouldn't evaluate the Israeli operation based on what we want. We have to see how Israel itself evaluating it.
So how is Israel is evaluating its operation?
Israel is evaluating it based on how much they managed to destroy, how much they could erase Gaza from existence. They consider it a win. Meanwhile, we keep saying that Israel is looking for hostages. But there were 253 hostages in Gaza, and they are not the priority.
Iran had a regional strategy. Hamas and Hezbollah, part of the axis of resistance, were the two key pillars of that strategy. And both are seriously damaged and degraded now. Does this mean a real loss of power and influence for Iran in the region?
It certainly seems so at the moment. Look, the balance of power is firmly on Israel's side militarily, politically, and economically, with, of course, the active participation of the United States and their imperial project in the region. Iran is not capable of winning a war against the U.S. It's not capable of ending Israeli settler colonialism in Palestine. People know that. I know that the discourse sometimes, you know, of course, the discourse coming from Iran and from the resistance movements will tend to overplay their ability and their power to stop Israel. But we're seeing that the reality on the ground in terms of balance of power is still firmly in Israel's favor. And at this moment, Israel is using its political capital to its capacity, maximum capacity. It's using its military and economic power, if not to maximal capacity, then a significant substantive portion of that capital. And Iran is not participating in this in terms of joining in as a regional war precisely because They know that they cannot withstand an assault by a U.S.-Israel alliance. So I do think that their power in the region has been dealt a blow. But Iran also plays a long game, and Mehran can speak about this better than I can. But they play a very long game, and they understand that their strategic vision is one that needs a long time to develop. So even though they've been dealt a blow here, my guess and my feeling is that they believe that they can recover from this over a long period of time, so long as things don't escalate even further. And that's why Israel wants to escalate things. In my view, we keep saying that nobody wants a regional war, nobody wants escalation, and that is true, but I believe it's except for Israel. Israel is the one that actually thinks that right now is the moment to strike. They have, like I said, used their political capital to its maximum capacity. They think, well, right now we're in the dumps in terms of our international reputation. So let's go ahead and try to achieve all of our goals now and then worry about rebuilding our political capital later. So I do think that the Israelis are pushing for an escalation, pushing for a regional war. Iran understands that that would not be in its favor, and hence why they're still hesitant to engage in that.
Now, let's remember that from Tehran's perspective, the axis of resistance is meant as a deterrent against Israel. It is meant so that the next war is not fought on Iranian soil, but is fought outside of Iran. So whether it is in southern Lebanon or in Yemen or wherever where Iran's adversaries might be. And so the way Tehran sees it is that it doesn't necessarily want to engage in Israel in a long or in a head-on collision, but it wants to inflict on Israel death by 1,000 paper cuts over time.
And yeah, but Mehran, you've already heard the suggestion that perhaps Israel will go a stage further now and directly attack Iran. And an interesting message on X, the former Twitter, from Jared Kushner, used to be chief advisor to his father-in-law, Donald Trump, in the White House. He said the reason why nuclear facilities have not been destroyed despite weak air defense systems is because Hezbollah has been a loaded gun pointed at Israel. And then he goes, there's no going back for Israel. They cannot afford now not to finish the job. They'll be hearing those sort of messages in Tehran and fearing that they're going to come under direct attack from Israel any moment, aren't they?
Well, that,
and won't they have to act?
Yes, exactly. But that kind of rhetoric is nothing new. Iranians have heard it before, particularly from figures associated with the Trump White House. So the Iranians have been prepared for that. Now, if it actually comes to that, if Israel or if Iran gets the sense that Israel is going to actually attack Iran, then I think all bets are off. But for the time being, I can't imagine Iran falling into a trap that Israel has been trying to lay for it for the last several months.
Iran will pay. That is the message from Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu after the Iranians launched a deadly missile attack against Israel. The IDF says about 180 missiles were fired at Israel, many of them intercepted. But a few got through, killing at least one person and injuring several others. Celebrations breaking out in the streets of Tehran moments after the rocket attacks subsided. The world now waiting to see how Israel will respond.
Iran made a big mistake tonight, and it will pay for it. The regime in Iran does not understand our determination to defend ourselves and our determination to retaliate against our enemies. We will stand by the rule we established. Whoever attacks us, we will attack him.
Iran's Armed Forces Chief of Staff dismissing that warning. He says Israel should prepare for more strikes if it continues aggression.
If the Zionist regime that has gone crazy is not controlled by America and Europe and wants to continue these crimes or wants to do anything against our sovereignty and territorial integrity, tonight's operation will be repeated several times stronger and all their infrastructure will be targeted.
the United States, which supports Israel still blindly and automatically, and I must emphasize in your show that the United States is a full partner for everything that Israel is doing in the last year, including the massacre in Gaza. Even the United States will wake up one day, and then what?
This comes all against the backdrop of a changing American political backdrop, you know, with the US election due in about 5 weeks' time. Joe Biden has been a staunch supporter of the Israeli leadership, Mr. Netanyahu. This is all taking place, though, as we look to November, we don't know what level of support will come for Israel and what it does. Does that affect at all, do you think, the calculation of how the government is acting and its own timeline?
I think it probably does. I think there is an acceptance here in Israel that Prime Minister Netanyahu would prefer it if the next president of the United States was Donald Trump again, because he thinks he has better support for Israel. But I don't think we're going to see any major shift in policy from the Americans in the run-up to the election. If we ended up with a Kamala Harris presidency, perhaps there could be a shift in direction.
I'm not convinced that there is a split between the United States and their European allies and Canada and Israel. It's a pantomime, it's a mirage. Netanyahu has been emboldened rather than restrained by these leaders. What is happening on the ground in Lebanon and Gaza continues to happen in Gaza. It is prima facie evidence that they are fully in support of what he's doing. Indeed, after the death of the Secretary General of Hezbollah, Joe Biden almost came instantly out with praise of the Israeli government for exacting some measure of justice. That's hardly the view of somebody who's trying to negotiate a temporary ceasefire.
Look at the second map. It's a map of a curse.
Netanyahu has shown throughout his long and disastrous career as prime minister that he's allergic to diplomacy. His appearance before the United Nations General Assembly late last month was evidence of that. The other almost obscene bit of chicanery that we have witnessed is Western news organizations. Suddenly, some of them are a little bit disturbed or perturbed by this broadening war, now suggesting that Netanyahu should stop what he's doing in Lebanon. When, a year ago, they all, almost universally, in lockstep with the politicians that they're supposed to hold accountable, encouraged, insisted that Netanyahu do precisely what he's doing now. Various human rights organizations all concluded that Israel was guilty of committing apartheid. These Western news organizations dismissed that report, barely gave it the coverage that it undoubtedly deserves, and set the tone for much of their coverage since. This bit of chicanery is not persuasive. We don't suddenly find a voice to say, we now need a truce, we now need peace, when all along we've been enabling a prime minister and a state at war.
I think that in any conversation, the context must put in place and be considered.
So to understand Israeli actions, you have to understand Israel as fundamentally a settler colonial project. And the goal of Israel since its founding is to create exclusive Israeli Jewish sovereignty over the entirety of the land of the historic Palestine from the river to the sea. And that means eliminating any resistance to that idea. So the October 7th became the pretext that the Israeli government needed in order to realize this dream of greater Israel and exclusive Israeli Jewish sovereignty over the entirety of the land, 100% of historic Palestine. They weren't satisfied with 78% of it that they took in 1948. And now they see this as a moment where they look at the resistance to that idea, and it's happening in Lebanon, in southern Lebanon, and it's happening in Yemen, it's happening in Iran, and it's happening in Palestine. Palestine, in Gaza and in the West Bank. And they believe that this is the moment for them to expel as many Palestinians as possible from their land, colonize as much of that land as possible, and eliminate all resistance to that idea, to that establishment of exclusive Israeli Jewish sovereignty.
In Gaza, the Israeli military is significantly increasing its attacks across the Strip, killing at least 60 Palestinians overnight and into Wednesday morning. Airstrikes targeted Gaza City in the north and Al-Nusayr at the refugee camp in central Gaza. In a ground operation in Khan Yunis in the south, Israeli forces killed at least 30 people, 12 from one family. Many residential buildings were destroyed while people were still inside. Medical sources say the Israeli army prevented paramedics and civil defense teams from reaching the bomb sites. Let's bring in our correspondent, Hani Mahmoud. He's joining us live from Deir al-Balah in central Gaza. And Hani, it's been a particularly deadly night across the Strip.
Yes, and it's taken everybody by surprise because it's the largest compared to the past few weeks. We look at the large number of casualties as a result of these deadly attacks across the central area for the southern part of the Strip, where the Israeli military conducted a ground invasion to the southern part of Khan Yunis city, where it destroyed a group of residential homes and including 12 people from one family and other five people from another family. That's a family of a journalist working for a local media platform. But here in the central area, the Israeli military carried out deadly attacks on evacuation centers and 10 sites housing displaced population, displaced people been sheltering, seeking protection and safety for the past months, not safe anymore because of these deadly attacks. And for the northern part of the Strip, the Israeli military carried attacks against residential buildings, an orphanage institute, that's Al Amal Institute for Orphanage in the center part of the Gaza Strip. But as far as we know, the facility turned into an evacuation center, a shelter for displaced families, including the orphans inside the facility itself. And a school also was targeted by the Israeli military. We're looking at it, close to 80 people have been killed in these overnight attacks and early hours of this morning, and 38 in the city of Khan Yunis. But as we were told by civil defense members, there are still more people under the rubble that they were prevented by the Israeli military and its quad captors and the surveillance drones from approaching the bomb site and rescuing people who could have survived these attacks. But 22 people here in the central area from the attacks on evacuation center and 10 sites, and further northern part, 25 people. This is the largest single number of casualties if we compare this to the past weeks. We're looking at four shelters have been attacked by the Israeli military, just deepening a sense of shattered safety for people already traumatized because of this war, seeking safety and protection inside these evacuation centers and in the tent sites that they set up and have been staying in for almost the past year.
Over the past 24 hours, Israeli strikes in Lebanon have killed at least 105 people, bringing the death toll over the past 2 weeks to over 1,000, with 6,000 people injured. The Israeli attacks have displaced about 1 million people in Lebanon. More than 100,000 have fled from Lebanon to Syria, according to the United Nations.
I've got to say that, you know, there's also the impact on the population here in Lebanon, because we've seen that hundreds of thousands of people have been displaced because of these Israeli attacks. At least 1,000 people have been killed. And authorities are warning that, you know, hospitals and shelters that have been, you know, housing those displaced residents are under pressure. And yesterday, the Prime Minister, Najib Mikati, warned that Lebanon was facing a very dangerous situation.
Middle East doesn't count. We've been bombing them for 40 years. They love it.
Thank you.
Yeah. The economic situation in the West Bank, we can say and describe it in one term. It's 100% dependent on the Israeli economy. Most of the economic activities were re-engineered and redirected to support the Israeli economy.
Welcome to This is Palestine. I'm Deanna Butu. In a few days, we will sadly mark 1 year of Israel's ongoing genocide in the Gaza Strip. Israel has used this time to push forward its land theft in the West Bank, stealing vast areas of land, destroying numerous Palestinian towns, and relentlessly working to dismantle what remains of the Palestinian economy. In this episode, we highlight Israel's control over the Palestinian economy. We also explore the historical factors that have contributed to the current state of the Palestinian economy. In order to better understand this, I speak to Ali Hamdullah, a policy analyst and economist who is from Tul Kerem. Ali is a researcher and strategist in development studies, and he has appeared a lot in Arab and international media. The Palestinian economy is not an independent one. Rather, like the land and the people, it too is under Israeli military control. Because the Palestinian Authority does not control any border crossings or any banks, the Palestinian government relies on tax revenues collected by Israel on the authority's behalf. This money is collected at international ports. This tax revenue accounts for 70% of the Palestinian Authority's budget. However, only about 50% of this money is now reaching the Palestinian Authority due to Israel unilaterally deducting, actually stealing, money that is owed to the Palestinian Authority. Money is deducted for a variety of reasons by Israel, with nobody stopping Israel or even holding them to account or to an accounting. For example, Israel deducts money for electricity, for water, for water treatment for Israeli settlements, yes, for the settlements, for medical transfers, and because they want to destroy the Palestinian economy. The Palestinian Ministry of Finance has reported that Israeli deductions for services such as electricity, water, sewage, and hospital bills from tax revenues have accumulated to roughly 20 billion shekels, that's $5.4 billion, since the year 2012. As a result, each month, about 250,000 Palestinian public sector employees await news on whether they will receive their salaries, and if so, what percentage will be paid. Now, there hasn't been a single month where Palestinian Authority employees have received their full salaries, and this uncertainty has persisted for years and only worsened since October of 2023. In fact, they have not yet received a single month full salary. What this means, of course, is that the largest sector, being the public service employees, are not getting their full salaries and in turn are unable to contribute to the economy, with people making fewer purchases, which in turn affects small business owners, and so on. The seizure of Palestinian funds has intensified, particularly following the appointment of Bezalel Smotrich as Israel's Minister of Finance. Smotrich has threatened to prevent Israeli banks from handling financial transfers to Palestinian banks. Now, as a result, the Palestinian Authority has been unable to meet its financial obligations, whether to its employees or to the private sector. In late May, the World Bank warned that the Palestinian Authority was at risk of, quote, collapse in public finances, unquote. For example, the Ministry of Health is now facing a staggering debt of $720 million, or 2.7 billion shekels. This is due to the fact that Palestinian patients requiring specialized medical care are transferred to Israeli hospitals, mostly, by the way, because the Israelis do not allow specialized medicines and equipment into the West Bank or the Gaza Strip. This debt has led to severe shortages of critical supplies, leaving the Ministry of Health unable to provide the necessary medicines and services to the remaining Palestinian population. It's important to note that when Palestinians are transferred to these Israeli hospitals, There is no accounting of what is done to these patients. Instead, the Palestinian Authority just receives a bill with no way of being able to follow up or check or even question what services have or have not been provided to these patients. Now, since the start of the war in October and until the end of December in 2023, the total losses to the Palestinian economy caused by the halt of production in Gaza and the impact of aggression in the West Bank have reached approximately $2.3 billion. This decline continues as the war enters its 12th month. But why is Israel able to control Palestinian money? The answer lies in the Oslo Accords.
That the security of the Israeli people will be reconciled with the hopes of the Palestinian people, this brave gamble that the future can be better than the past must endure.
In 1994, the Palestinian Authority and Israel signed the Oslo Accords, an agreement that was supposed to lead to peace and independence for Palestinians, but in reality, it was a means of Israel cementing its control over the West Bank and Gaza Strip with Palestinian acquiescence. The Accords, particularly through the Paris Protocol, set the foundation for economic relations between Israel and the Palestinian Authority. On a practical level, it granted Israel full control over key aspects of the Palestinian economy, including customs, its monetary policy, taxation, and so on.
Due to the Oslo Accords in 1994, Israel should collect the taxes on behalf of the Palestinian Authority, then transfer the taxes to the authority after taking about 3%. Two-thirds of the Palestinian Authority revenues comes from these taxes. So Israel directly controls, according to the Oslo Accords, two-thirds of our national budget on a monthly basis. That gave a hegemony tool for Israel to always blackmail the Palestinians and the Palestinian Authority to shallow and narrow their political ceiling or aspirations. 245,000 of Palestinians are direct beneficiaries of the Palestinian Authority as employees or other categories like the social services or etc. When we are talking about 245,000 Palestinians multiplied by, let's say, 5%, which is the average number of Palestinian households, we are talking about 1 million Palestinians who are directly dependent on the Palestinian Authority's salaries, etc.
Now, in addition to depriving the Palestinian employees of their salaries, Palestinians who were previously allowed to work in Israel have been barred from doing so since October, which has even further worsened the economic crisis. According to the Palestinian General Federation of Workers, approximately 225,000 Palestinians were employed in Israel until October the 7th, with total wages amounting to 1.3 billion shekels, or about $362 million. It's important to note that people worked inside Israel because they had to, because the Israelis continue to control the Palestinian economy. So, why not separate from the Israeli economy? Because it's impossible. Israel controls all ports of entry, it controls the banks, and Israel prevents the Palestinian Authority from issuing its own currency. This means that there is no Palestinian autonomy in managing interest rates, in managing inflation, and in a broader monetary policy. Trade and labor are similarly restricted, with Israel maintaining control over ports and border crossings, and essential resources like land, water, and natural assets remaining under Israeli control. In short, the Oslo Accords institutionalize economic dependency of the Palestinian territories on Israel, severely limiting their economic sovereignty.
The inflation effect in the West Bank is magnified, actually because of the fragility of our economy and because we don't have the institution of a central bank which will design fiscal and monetary policies to support the Palestinians.
Israel's complete control over the Palestinian economy has been used as a tool to pressure Palestinians by linking any form of political activism, whether it be military resistance, legal efforts, or cultural initiatives, with their economic conditions. What this means is that we both see that Israel will tighten the economy when it sees that there is any activism, and we similarly see the donors do the same through their conditionality. Israel openly acknowledges this tactic, as seen in the recent invasion of Jenin, where markets and infrastructure were deliberately targeted. Israeli authorities made it clear to the citizens of Jenin that the destruction would continue if resistance persisted, directly tying the invasions and devastation to acts of resistance in the city. Now, going back to the Second Intifada, Israel's strategy was to create a bubble of comfortable living for Palestinians, particularly in the West Bank, entirely controlled by Israeli mechanisms and easily dismantled at any time. The aim was to reduce resistance to Israel's colonial system by promoting a sense of relaxation and modernity.
An imaginary ordinary life in a very, very not ordinary situation, which is the occupation situation. The settlements are expanding on a daily basis since 1948. They never stopped expansion of the settlements. That means our geography is shrinking, which will directly affect our agriculture and our industrial factories, which will lead in the conclusion to be more and more dependent on the Israeli economy. At the same time, Palestinians are losing these sectors, which are bases and are the infrastructure for any state solution. You can't have a Palestinian real estate as a political solution, let's say the two-state solution, without having your own sovereignty while we have this deformed economy. The Palestinians will always be more fragile, more poor, more unemployed, and the Israelis will live in bitter and bitter life conditions.
Why, because this is my land.
But this is my house.
I was given it by God.
Shame,
and Abraham,
shame. Hey,
shut
no.
The fuck up.
This is Run my house.
Not your
this
house.
Is, okay, no. That's your house?
Yeah.
Okay, you came with double faces and your guns.
Tell your crazy witch to go.
Historically, the Palestinian community was largely agricultural, relying on land and production of our own crops. However, Israel's shift aimed to diminish Palestinian agricultural production, transforming Palestinians into a workforce dependent on service sectors rather than on production. Israel made agriculture difficult and unaffordable through its confiscation of vast areas of land and through restrictions imposed on Palestinian farmers. Ali highlights that it's not just Israel controlling the Palestinian Authority's finances and, by extension, the lives of Palestinians through economic means. It's also Israel's allies who have played a significant role in this influence.
After the Palestinian Second Intifada, these grants were declined in major and significant ways, from about 45% of the Palestinian Authority revenues into less than 7%. Before a few years, due to many factors, one of them is COVID-19, but for other political factors, this share or this contribution started to decrease also directly on permanent way, month by month, to reach a ceiling which is less than 7% in 2022. Less than 7% of the Palestinian Authority total revenues. This decrease or this turbulence of the share of external donations and the grants is used also as a tool to enhance the dependency of the Palestinians in economic and political aspects, and also to continue the blackmailing for the Palestinians.
Critics of the Palestinian Authority argue that since 1994, the Palestinian Authority has lacked a clear plan or objective, despite facing financial blackmail and withholding of finances. The Palestinian Authority has not taken any effective measures against Israel. Now, Smotrich has announced a plan undermining and causing the complete collapse of the Palestinian Authority. This plan seeks to undermine the PA's legitimacy further diminishing its standing among Palestinian citizens. And its aim is the economy.
The trade and services sector is actually expanding in huge ways, creating a financial bubble. This big financial bubble actually is laying on a needle in the Smotrich's hand. He can explode it directly by one decision.
After 31 years, many Palestinians, including Ali, believe that it is time to crucially reassess the legal and structural foundations of the Oslo Accords.
We think that Oslo now is not a treaty or a deal or an agreement between both parties. Oslo now is a tool, one-sided tool, used by Israelis to constrain and control Palestinians from political and economic aspects. Palestinians should rethink the economic model we have in West Bank. We should rely more on the productive sectors because Israeli attacked our productive sectors, the industrial sector and the agriculture sector. They attacked it in a systematic way for decades now. From 1967, we are describing a very fragile economic situation.
Thank you for listening to This is Palestine, a podcast brought to you by the Institute for Middle East Understanding. The IMEU is a nonprofit focused on giving you access to untold stories, facts, and expert sources on all things Palestine. For more information, please visit our website at www.imeu.org and follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at the IMEU. Please don't forget to subscribe. I'm Deanna Butu. Thanks for listening.
That's it for us for today. You are listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Until next time, I wish you a free, free Palestine.